is Patsy with the Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, this has been a really great week in the publishing world. There are two really exciting deals that were made. The first one is what they call a six-figure preempt. Woo, that's nice. It means that there was some fear out there from a publisher that if it went to auction, it would the price would just go higher and higher. So in order to stop an auction, they just said, okay, let's just offer a big six-figure deal. And this one went to a new author. Her name is Emily Neuberger, and she's written she's writing it. I don't know if it's even finished. And it's called A Tender Thing. It's an interesting concept. It's about Broadway in the 1950s, a sort of a love story, and talking about the social problems of integrating the theater at that time. Anyway, Emily is a very happy person today because she got this six-figure preempt. Now, as I've mentioned, if you are looking for an agent, you want an agent who is getting deals. And the best way to find agents who are getting deals is to go to Publishers Weekly and go to the page that's called Deals of the Week. And you will see there that for this one, the deal was made by Christy Fletcher and Sarah Fuentes, Fletcher and Company, and wow, they are also happy today because they get a nice commission. Okay, well, I'm now just waiting. I'm going to get a wonderful call from, two doctors who are going to be here to talk about something really fascinating and something that's great to be reading at the beginning of the year. When everybody is making resolutions to diet, get in shape, and just generally feel better about themselves. So it's always exciting when Nat Geo sends me books. They send me so many wonderful books, and I do appreciate them because they are always so beautifully written and so interesting. And this particular book, I must compliment them because they really have come out with them. A book that is not only beautiful, the cover is just lovely. It's really one that you want to just keep around. And, of course, as always, Nat Geo books are just the very best, the top quality. And I tell you, if you are looking for a gift for someone, this is also one of a lovely book. It's coming up to Valentine's Day. So if you're looking for a book that you might want to give somebody to just inspire them, and there are just so many Nat Geo books, and they are always priced so reasonably. It's really amazing with the quality of the books. I sit there sometimes just looking at the books. I always, with a Nat Geo book, you can go through it many times, and you just are so amazed that they can keep such high quality at such reasonable prices. So there's a wide range of books, and you can go to my website, which is radio-joyonpaper.com, and I have a special section there for gift books, because it is just, as I tell all of you, to give a book is one of the best gifts that you can give, because it's, first of all, it might just be the right book at the right time to inspire someone. And then it's something that they can treasure for years to come. It is just wonderful. I have books that were given to me many years ago, or even when I was a child, and I pick up those books. I keep those books in a special section of my bookcase, and I just open them up, and I look at the messages to me from the past. But today, I am talking to two doctors, wow, this is exciting, about a wonderful new book called What to Eat When. And I have on the phone with me Dr. Michael Roizen and Dr. Michael Krupain. Did I pronounce those names right?
You did, Patsy.
Okay, well, I am so thrilled to have you on the program. As I was telling my listeners at the beginning of the hour, this is a perfect book to start the year off because, wow, you can get yourself in shape and just get to understand yourself a little bit more. So why don't we explain who you are? You can each introduce yourself, and then we'll talk about why it is important to know about our natural clock and when we should eat. So who wants to start?
This is Mike. So we go by Mike and Michael is the easy way for you. Mike Roizen is my last name. I'm the chief wellness officer at the Cleveland Clinic and both an internist and anesthesiologist. And have been involved in aging research as that's the way to decrease complications after surgery. That's how I started and bridged into the field of what do we do to slow down our aging process or even reverse it. And so I was lucky enough to come up with a real age concept, which 65 million people have taken the real age test. The WEN Way is kind of as we call it, the WENWAY.com, is kind of a broader view of the new science that says it's important when you eat as much as it is what you eat. Michael?
Yeah, so I'm Michael Krupain, and I'm a physician trained in preventive medicine. My passion is figuring out how to make the world a healthier place, and right now I'm the medical director at the Dr. Oz Show.
And you are also someone who loves to cook.
I do love to cook. Cooking is one of my big passions.
Well,
and so when we wrote this book, because we were really impressed by the literature and the science out there that was showing that when we eat is actually just as important as what we eat. And it's, as you were saying, it has to do with our body's clock, and that's called our circadian rhythm. And its job is to get our body ready to do the right thing at the right time. And we all know it for sleep or when we go travel somewhere and we get jet lag, we know our body clock is messed up. Well, it also influences our metabolism, and our metabolism actually changes throughout the day. But when you eat in line with your metabolism, with when your body wants you to eat, you're kind of hacking it. So you can get better health, you can lose more weight, you can just feel better. And what your body wants is it wants you to eat with the sun. It wants you to eat more early, so making breakfast and lunch your biggest meals of the day, and eat less later, so making dinner your smallest.
Well, this is very funny because I was raised in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I'm a Youper, and up there, we get up early. And I have all of my life, I have gotten up at 5 o'clock in the morning. My day starts at 5 a.m. And I'm always so happy that generally by 9 a.m, I'm done with my major work. And the rest of the day, which works out fine for me, I can read. So I really, I like the idea of starting eating, you know, relatively early in the morning. And by evening, my family's like saying, why aren't you eating dinner? And I mean, I eat a little bit, but just to be sociable, but I don't need to eat at that time of the night.
Yeah, so you're already on the WEN Way.
Yes.
So that's great. So what I think a lot of people are surprised, and you've experienced this yourself, is that when you start doing what we're recommending, when you eat the WEN Way, when you eat more early and less later, your appetite actually does change. So both Mike and I were a little skeptical about this, but the research showed this, and we've experienced it, and so have you, that when you move your calories up in the day, you actually can get by with eating a smaller meal later. Or even for me, I usually don't eat at all, except like you, to be social. So I think that's one of the big surprises that people have, is that it actually is so much easier than it sounds.
Well, I think it's a farmer, my grandfather was a farmer. I loved to get up with him. And then later on, my mother was a baker, so I got up with her. And it's just a habit that I think just works so nicely. And I think you have more energy in the morning. I am always surprised when people sort of are sluggish in the morning and they don't move fast and they're complaining about being awake. And I'm just the opposite. I'm like a powerhouse in the morning.
That's exactly right. There are three surprises as people have converted to this that you've already discovered one of them at least. And that is, actually you've discovered two of them. One is that they feel much more energy when they eat this way. And so 3 days after I started doing this, not only was I not hungry at night, that's surprise number one like you had, but surprise two is you feel much more energy in the daytime. I felt like I was 20 years younger. And the third thing is, if you will, you sleep much better at night. So sleep better, more energy, not hungry at night. They all go with this way of eating, which makes sense because it's what your circadian rhythm wants you to do to get more energy and to feel great.
Well, how did you come across it for yourself? And then how did you decide to put it out there to explain to people? And what should they know about the whole process?
Well, Mike and I were doing research into the timing of eating because it started appearing in the animal literature about 7, maybe as long as 10 years ago. And believe it or not, fruit flies are a great model for human heart disease, and we can get into that later. But fruit flies are one of the models for this that started the human studies. And my favorite study of all, most of the human studies are the last 2 to 3 years, and my favorite study is one from Spain, where they took a whole mess of people, both men and women, who were trying to lose weight. In Spain, the biggest meal is at midday, and they looked at those who ate before 2 p.m. versus those who ate after 3 p.m. They had the same number of calories, same food, but the group that ate before 2 p.m. lost 25%. That's a big number, 25% more weight than the group that ate after 3 p.m. So that was about the third study in humans. There are now more, and then we've done it on our own patients and ourselves, obviously, as well as some subjects. And it really does, one, it isn't that tough to do. 3 days into it, you feel all the changes, the increased exercise, the lack of hunger at night, and the better sleep. And then all of a sudden, so you say, well, I could do this the rest of my life as you have been doing it. And so as an upper, I guess. And so all of us, the data were just there is why we wanted to get it out, because it is so different than most people were talking about. And at the Cleveland Clinic, where I am the chief wellness officer, people are trying to lose weight. And when you find out they're eating the right food, they're just not eating at the right time. And when you switch them to the right time, all of a sudden it jump starts their weight loss and they get over that hump that they've been on for so long.
Now, as part of this program of the book, you have in here the 30-day sort of customized program. What is that, so that people could understand and look for in your book?
Yeah, well, that's getting people to eat the Wen way. So just like when you're jet-lagged, your body takes a little time to adjust. When you're shifting the way you're eating, we think you should do it over a period of time. You don't have to. You could do it all at once if you want to. It's sort of up to you. But if you gradually change the way you eat, it'll be easier, and your appetite will adjust a little bit over time, and your energy will adjust over time, so it's not sort of happening all at once. And one of the main pieces of advice we give is to think about your dinner. Imagine your dinner was all on one plate, and you divided that plate up into four pieces, like you drew four lines on it, so it had four quarters on it. And each day you take one of those quarters and save it for the next day, so that you're eating 25% less dinner every day and 25% more breakfast or lunch the next day. And until you get to a point where your dinner is much smaller, about a quarter of what it used to be, and your breakfast and lunch are bigger. That's one of the first steps. And the next steps are, again, adjusting your time and then adjusting some of the foods to be the healthier foods, the whole grain, the lean proteins, and the nuts and seeds that people aren't getting enough.
Well, it is a big problem. In the world, we have this enormous problem now of so many people being overweight, and it's hard with the type of fast food that people can pick up at any time. When you see lines of cars at the fast food late in the evenings, it is worrying.
Yes, I think that is a big problem we have. Is our environment makes it so easy to eat too much and to eat the wrong foods and to eat them at the wrong time. So when you're eating the Wen way, when you're following the advice we have in What to Eat When, you have to think a little bit about it. You have to plan a little bit. And that can make a big difference. And by having a plan, you're ready to face those scenarios where you find yourself hungry, or you're working late, or you're on a trip or whatever. You've made a plan so that you're not stuck eating whatever you find sort of is easiest thing right in front of you. And that's actually the half of the book is about different scenarios you may encounter in your everyday life, because not every day is the same. And so we go through everything from what to eat when you're at a stadium, to what you eat on a road trip, to what to eat to prevent heart disease.
Well, now, you know, Michael, from your point of view, when you started your interest in cooking, you've been cooking right for a long time. So this really made you aware of what foods were good for people and what they should eat. And that comes through, I think, in your book. Tell us some of the things that people should really, really, I mean, seriously try to avoid if they're looking for this year to make it the year that they're going to slim down.
Let me take that, if you will, Michael. So the key with food is you want it to be a relationship. So just like you wouldn't be married to someone who didn't love you back, that's how you should treat food. Food is a relationship. So French fries may taste great, but they're killing you. You shouldn't have them. It's a one-way relationship. So you want the relationship to be, we love food, and it loves us back. So there are four foods, if you will, that really don't love us back, or groups. One is simple sugars and added sugars or syrups and simple carbohydrates. Why? Because they turn into blood sugar quickly, and that changes the way our proteins function. The second, the fourth one, is foods with saturated fat, such as red meat and processed red meat and egg yolks and much of milk and or dairy products. And the reason that doesn't work is because the proteins in them cause some difficulty with our functioning of the bacteria inside us. So we have a bunch of bacteria inside our gut called our microbiome. And when you eat, for example, carnitine, the stuff in red meat, the amino acid in red meat, it changes the bacteria inside you to produce largely as its waste product, trimethylamine and butylbutane. Those go to the liver and get transformed, but they get transformed into something that increases your risk of heart disease and stroke, decreases your ability to fight cancer, increases your risk of inflammation in your brain leading to dementia, and over the long term causes chronic kidney failure and high blood pressure. So the key is you want to avoid those four groups of food. The fifth one is trans fat. That's largely been eliminated by the regulations of the FDA because it's a poison, if you will, for your cells. But eliminating those four foods really makes a huge difference. Everything else is what you love. So if you love avocado, have it. If you love walnuts, have those. If you love salmon the way I do, or resistant starch pasta like Michael does, have those things. But remember 75% before 2 p.m. and eat only when the sun is out the way you do.
Well, you know, I lived in the Middle East where when we were there, of course, we ate our big meal at noon and slept from 2 to 5 every day. And the offices would open up back at 5 o'clock. So it was really actually that was also just a perfect lifestyle. And we, unlike in Spain, they did not eat a heavy meal at the end of the, you know, in the evenings. It was a much lighter meal of yogurt and cucumbers and stuff like that.
I think we can learn a lot from other countries around the world who are eating like that or like you do. And also the other thing is they're eating different foods for breakfast, right, than we are. So we are typically eating the foods that don't love you back that Mike was talking about. And we're telling you it's okay to eat regular food like dinner foods for breakfast. Don't stereotype your food. It's okay to have salmon for breakfast or pasta for breakfast or a big salad for breakfast like you do.
That's funny. I just had salmon for breakfast. I could eat salmon every day if I could afford it.
You and Mike would be good friends.
Yeah, well, and let me tell you a way you can afford it that's really great. So I don't have any financial interest in any way in Costco, but Costco has salmon burgers, 10 to a pack. They're relatively inexpensive, and they also have salmon fillets that are inexpensive. and not the fresh ones, the frozen ones, and they're the overage of the Alaska salmon run. So they're actually the healthiest salmon, cut into perfect pieces for one person having it at a time, great on price, and incredible on both taste and quality. So that's one. I'm sure other stores have it that way, too, but I can tell you that's a really inexpensive way of getting great-tasting salmon.
And it is just so good for you. And I love the taste, and when I don't have salmon, I have herring. So I work it out there.
Yeah, that's great.
Now, this book is just, as always with a Nat Geo book, it is done so beautifully. The cover is gorgeous. And I think that the way it's laid out, it's also, there's something sort of cheerful about it. It's not one of those depressing, kind of things that make you feel bad. There's so much encouragement in this book, and you guys have written such a, just I think, taken such a nice attitude that I really think all of my listeners will enjoy this book. And as I was suggesting, it's a great book. Valentine's Day is coming up. I think it's a great book to share and to give as a gift. One, because it's so beautiful. I just like it. I want to keep it on my kitchen counter there. It's so beautiful. And I think you guys have done a terrific job.
Thank you so much.
You're so nice, Betsy.
Well, Thank you. It's always so important, and as I said, it's the beginning of the year, and I hope that people will get this book. And is there a website or anything where they can get more information about this, or what should they do?
Yeah, we have a website. It's wenway.com. We've got a blog on there and recipes and more information coming, and then we have a pretty active Instagram account. It's wen.way. You can follow us there as well.
Okay. Well, I just want to thank you so much. You are just, I think you're fascinating, and you've come out with a really great book. And I just want to repeat your name so that people will know them.
It's Mike Roizen.
And
Michael Krupain. So I just, again, the name of the book is What to Eat When, and get the book, go to the website, and follow it along, and boom! This can be the whole year of transformation, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thanks, guys. It's been a real joy to talk to you today.
The joy's ours. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now. Oh, wow.
Bye-bye.
That's nice. Okay, it is a beautiful book, and I am more and more into this. I think it's very true. There was a time when I did like eat in the evenings, and now I realized a while back, I realized that's not good. It's too heavy. So I have completely gone the other way, my natural way, because as I said, I am up at 5 o'clock. I am up every morning at 5 o'clock, and it is so really wonderful for all of you. If you've done everything, either you're going to write, if you're a writer, you just get all your writing done, and by 9 o'clock, you're feeling so good. And you can get, I start off, of course, with coffee, but by 9 o'clock, you can sit down and have a really, reward yourself with a really great breakfast, a healthy breakfast, and just feel good. Okay, now I'm going to take a commercial break, and then we're going to come back, and I have a very fascinating author I want to talk to.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I am so thrilled that I'm going to be talking now to an author whose book is, it's brilliant, and it's lovely, and I am really, really happy to be talking to Lisa Riddick. Lisa, are you there?
I am. Good morning, Patsy. Thank you for your kind words.
Wow.
Good to talk to you.
I tell you, I got this book a while back, and I've been waiting to talk to you because it is a book that just, well, it is about a river, and it just, your book just flows so beautifully. Mm-hmm. It hits rapid parts, it hits wild parts, it hits gentle parts, and it is really poetic and just a lovely, lovely book. And the name of it is The Same River. Wow, tell us about it.
Well, it's a story that's partially based on my own life story growing up on the North Umpqua River in Oregon, in the town of Roseburg. And we moved there from Los Angeles when I was 9 years old. And other than wanting a horse more than anything, I really loved being out in the wild and growing up on that river. Part of the sad story and also what informs this book is that when I was 14 years old, my 11-year-old sister drowned in the river behind our house. And for me, as a 14-year-old girl who was riding her horses in the mountains and fishing and hunting and, you know, loving the wildness of nature, it was, of course, devastating. And so the novel begins with the story of my going back to the river after my sister had died. And that's a stepping off point for the novel. The novel then goes through lots of different issues, for example, the Native American history of the river, as well as issues surrounding salmon laws, dam removal. So it does flow in and out of different times and different stories, but the stepping off point for the story is my own history of living on the river.
Well, it is, as I said, it's a beautiful book, and it touches on so many subjects: environmental science, this Native American spirituality, and of course, a mystical connection with a Native American. And there was many things that, as I was reading it, partly because I love nature, and I was I was raised in the Upper Peninsula. As a child, I ran wild. For kids who don't know that feeling, for all the kids who are sitting there with those things and they're playing with those machines, I feel so sorry for them because my childhood was so wild. I mean, I would kiss my mom goodbye in the morning and I'd have a jar of Kool-Aid and peanut butter sandwiches, and the rest of the day was out there on the shores of Lake Superior in the forest, eating berries, just that joy of nature. And that's what comes across in this book, that pure joy of, I mean, trees, the sound of the running water. And of course, I was on the shores of Lake Superior, but we had all these little rivulets coming in off, you know, it was fantastic.
Yeah, oh, I know, Patsy, exactly that feeling. And the feeling, too, of really wanting to inspire people to remember at this time more than ever that we are connected to nature and that nature is so important for our young people, for their development, for us right now. You know, it wasn't, we always kind of harken back to our wild childhood, and we are still those wild children and child, and that we still have that desire to get out there and get dirty and, you know, run in the forest and do things that give us that kind of joy and grounds us in our beings and in our who we are as people and as, you know, human animals on this beautiful planet, because there's so many things that are tugging at our attention right now to keeping us away from that joy and from that sense of connection and relationship. And so, you know, it's my hope that my story will help inspire that for people and remind us all that, you know, that's who we are and that's what we love. And from that, maybe find ways to better take care of each other and our planet.
And that youthful joy of being free and wild can sustain us through a lot of troubles in our life. We can have that moment where we can just take a sort of a deep breath and remember and recall that time. So I found your book just very touching, where, you know, you, of course, you suffered so much, but what you also did is found this in this case, what is the name? The name of the river is Nasika that you write
Nasika,
about.
Yeah,
but the
yeah.
real river that you lived on was what?
The North Umpqua River. That's in Oregon, Central Oregon. If anybody ever on the West Coast drives up and down I-5, you cross the North Umpqua River. It's like in Central Oregon. So a lot of people are, oh, I've heard of that. So, you know, people in the West can... I kind of remember that, but it's also the story of every river, Patsy. You know, when I finished my research for the book, I just had a sense of, like, there's stories like this for every blue vein that runs through, you know, our mountains and our hills and our valleys. That, you know, people have lost their lives, people have found joy, people have, you know, subsisted. The Native American people relied on the river in a very different way than we do now and had a different relationship with it. So that was important to me, too, is that it wasn't just my personal story, but there was something, what I wanted to tell about my story was universal, and people could relate to, oh, I remember, you know, on the Mackenzie River or the, you know, Dulce Wallops River and different stories about different rivers. So that's why at the beginning of the book I start with not just the, you know, the drowning of my sister, but my going back to the river and how powerful that was and how that gave me strength. And ultimately, by being close to the river again, I found that sense of joy and connection in a really deep, important way. And respect for nature, because, you know, nature isn't always kind and not always beautiful. And sometimes we romanticize the wild places. And I really wanted to make it real and help people, you know, kind of feel the feelings of my characters and go through what they go through and that they survive. And, you know, go ahead.
Tell us about the environmental science aspect of your life and of the book.
Well, the book is actually a product of my PhD dissertation in a field called ecopsychology. And ecopsychology began in the early 90s in Northern California, of course, where all good psychologies are born.
Yes, and we having lived there, we are all tree huggers.
Oh yes, we are. So it's perfect for, you know, I mean, it kind of grew out of some conversations in some Berkeley living rooms, and I was part of the first ever gathering at the F1 Institute on the coast of California. Yeah, I know, perfect place. It was awesome. I was there with some pretty well-known psychologists, some Harvard psychologists, some environmental activists from Greenpeace. It was actually being organized by Theodore Roszak, who wrote the book Making of a Counterculture. He's kind of well-known for that, or was. And he had written a book called The Voice of the Earth. And I was working on my master's degree at the time in psychology. And when I saw that book, I was like, that's what I'm doing. I want to use my love of writing, my love of poetry, and my care for nature with what I know about psychology. So it was a natural kind of segue for me into my professional life. And so I was part of that, and then I went on to develop a two-year program as a master's program in ecopsychology at Antioch University, Seattle, which was very successful for many years. And so, when I put together my PhD program, I said, well, can I write a work of fiction as a way of talking about what's going on in the natural world around us and environmental issues? So I'm not kind of playing into the blame and shame that is so typical of environmentalism. So the book is really intended to be a good story, a teaching story in a way, that talks about these issues, that talks about science, that talks about complexity and the different characters embody different, you know, people I actually interviewed for my data set that I drew on when I crafted the novel. And so it really is attached to my desire to talk about these things in a way that's not like, oh my God, the sky is falling. I mean, it is falling. That's true. But, you know, I mean, we can talk about it that way, or we can tell a good love story, throw in a cute dog, and, you know, have people kind of learn as they're reading and learn from my characters and their feelings and how they're responding to different issues and things that are going on in their lives.
Well, you've done it very successfully. As somebody who one time participated in a demonstration when they were trying to encroach on Muir Woods.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was a long time ago. But, you know, and of course, just with my love of nature, that I thought, wow, this book will really, I think, it's wonderful when a book, you learned something. I always love to learn something from a book. And then for me, as I'm reading, I'm saying, this is such a beautiful love story. And so people could be reading it just as a love story. They could be reading it as a mystery. They could be reading it as a conspiracy about dams.
Yeah.
You know, but in so many levels, but they're learning. And, of course, one of the things, of course, is about the way that you really did so beautifully bring in this Native American aspect. Because when I was also living in northern Michigan, I spent half my days searching for arrowheads. And so I had my own, you know, secret friend, a Native American boy in my case. He was invisible to everybody else, but I believed in him, and I believed that I was running, you know, running through the forest with him. So how did you come out with that idea? That was a sort of like a little extra bonus that you put in there.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for your kind words, Patsy. That's very sweet. And yeah, I really appreciate how connected you are to the story. And as you're talking, it's like I'm hearing my own childhood. So yeah, we do share a lot in common. Yes, being in the mountains and being Indians. And so the Native American character came from my research, because part of what I wanted to do was tell a story about loss, about this river. And I couldn't tell the story without talking about the tribe of people that actually lived in the upper reaches of the North Umpqua River. They were called the Molalla people, and they were known even by the Native Americans who lived on the lower river as the Wild Ones. So they lived way high up in the mountains. Not much was known about them. When I was doing my research, I contacted the fellow at Lewis and Clark, Stephen Dow Beckham, who's the local authority on these people and their anthropology and the archaeology of the area. And I contacted him. I said, I'm writing about these Native American tribes that lived on the North Umpqua. Do you have any information? And he said, well, it's really good that you're writing fiction because not a lot is known about them. So for my research, I literally would go up on the river and sit in the areas where there were stone piles, where they were known to have been, and just contacted her. She just came to me and started telling me her story. And so I that part of the book and that part of the research was very much just sitting and being in those places and listening to the sounds that of the river and the forest that would have been like 200 years ago. And it was very powerful, and it just flowed. Like, you know, like I said, the story does flow. And so her story, it came from, you know, some research I did, but also just from knowing that there were three waves of smallpox that hit the Western tribes before there was any contact with white Euro-Americans. So by the time the first settlers came to the western part of the country, they were decimated by disease. So for PS people, I was imagining what it was like for them to be getting sick and not knowing why they were sick or how to take care of each other. So that's where I can went into the visionary stuff and their grieving and their loss and then the strength of their people to, you know, be together and for that character to go through what she goes through. And that's why it's important, you know, when the book gets to the magical realism parts where they're starting to sense each other across time, you know, that's the gift of the story, is that we do have that wisdom and access to that wisdom. If we take the time and, you know, connect with our deeper selves in the natural world, our, you know, ourselves in relationship to the stories of the land that we are living on. So she was, yeah, she was amazing to write, and I'm so grateful.
It's so exciting for a writer when one of these characters comes to you, and they really do. You don't know where they come from, but they become so much a part of you, and you understand them, and you feel them. I have this connection with a character that I'm writing about, and it's very strange. I mean, this is 1875 India, and but I know this character. I mean, I know him so well, and it's so for me. When it came, it's like the whole there was a person there, and so I feel that with Pia because I absolutely believe she was there.
Yeah. Oh, I do too. Yeah. I mean, there's no question. And it's, I mean, writers often say that. It's like, you know, I'm writing along and I've met, this happens to me. I'm writing along. There's a knock on the door and I'm like, oh gosh, who is it going to be? And in walks a character and I'm like, oh, who are you? So, and fortunately, I've had lovely editors supporting me and helping me, you know, develop a kind of confidence in that exchange or in that relationship with the characters, you know, letting it be real, letting it be powerful, listening to them, you know. And people ask me about writing, and I said, well, to be a good writer, you have to be a good listener, and to be able to kind of put aside your own agenda and let the characters kind of speak through you. And Pia really taught me about that, and I was so grateful for her presence and for, you know, her guidance and, you know, her sharing her story with us.
Because I was thinking, oh my goodness, if you didn't have Pia, it would still be a, you know, a fine book, but she just gives it such depth and such, it's really so thrilling to have her as a character in there because you have made her, I mean, she is real. I defy anyone to say she's not real. I never felt, you know, you get into a book sometimes, you say, this person, this character is absolutely real. And I thought, oh, wow. Right away, I realized, oh, wow, Lisa is inspired.
Oh, thank you. That's so kind. Yeah, inspired and brave. And, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about all the research I did and the interviews that are compilations of the other, you know, the characters are compilations of all these actual people I talked to, and that Pia really wasn't, you know. I mean, she just was pure insight or pure intuition, and inspired by, you know, going to museums and looking at baskets and trying to, you know, feel my way into her world. And like I said, imagining what it's like, what it was like, the nights of the sound of the night animals walking around, you know, the animals who were there that aren't there anymore, the sound of the, you know, the dams below where her sacred places were, you know, wasn't there, you know. So it's kind of imagining past all of that or back into a time when that wasn't there, which, you know, also gives us hope for what could be in the future. So, yeah, she was really fun to write. And, and very, very sensual in terms of how she felt the world around her. And I think that goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the joy of being in nature and being like childlike in nature, you know, not like, you know, it's just like that openness and vulnerability and connection and how natural it is for her. So.
And I just wish everybody, lately I've been trying to eat more berries only because, you know, they're good for you. But they still do not have, there's no way they have that flavor of berries that you pick up in the wild.
Exactly. Yeah, the huckleberries around here are amazing.
So plentiful. Just to pick up the berries and wash them and eat them just like that, it's like, wow. I wish every kid could experience it instead of sitting there with those pads and those things that just, you know, they do it all with their thumbs, and I think, oh my gosh, I spent my childhood picking berries.
That's right, I did too.
You know, it was so much more fun. Really, it was.
I know. I was telling somebody the other day, they asked about kind of how I became like an environmentalist. I said, well, you know, when I was probably 5 years old in Los Angeles, there were hills behind our house, and I would go up and make little dens and hide in caves and eat the berries, and I guess they weren't poisonous or I wouldn't be here. So, I guess it's true for you too, Patsy.
Exactly. I think you've done a really great job with this book, because I think it will open so many people's eyes, and it's called The Same River, and it is, your name is Lisa M. Reddick. And it's spelled R-E-D-D-I-C-K. Of course, The Same River is available on Amazon and where books are sold. Now, is this a place where people can find out more about you? Are you on Facebook? Where are you?
I'm working on my social media skills. I'm at Lisa Reddick 77 on Twitter. The Same River is a page on Facebook, and I do a lot of postings there. I just posted some eagles singing along the Stillaguamish River up here in Washington State the other day. So I do some interesting posting on Facebook. LisaReddick.com is my website. It's quite beautiful. It was still kind of under construction, and I'm trying to post and blog more often. So, yeah, so that's where you can find me. And, yes, of course, on Amazon and whether books are sold, especially your independent bookstore.
yes, do try to find an independent bookstore and buy a book there, because it's so important that we keep these bookstores going. Lisa, I want to thank you so much. I think the book is inspiring, and it's inspired, and I think it will open a lot of people's eyes, and I think a lot of people will say, you know, it's about time I get out of the city and go and walk along a river and just feel that special feeling that we get when we hear the sound of a river flowing, and I think you've done a terrific job.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much, Patsy. I so appreciate it. And, yes, it's certainly the intent of the story is to help people remember that.
And I hope that you're working, because you are now, I will tell you, you're a brilliant writer. So I hope you're working on another story. And to tell you the truth, I wouldn't mind having Pia back, because...
I know. Well, I'm working on a sequel, so...
Okay.
You know, so
oh,
yes,
good.
I am.
Oh, good, because as I was saying, it's... You know, you don't get this with every book, where you get a character who you will always remember, and I will remember her, and I will remember you, and I hope that maybe next year you'll be back here again.
I will. I know. I'm not going to take as much time with the next book.
Okay.
So it's in the works. I promise.
Okay, great.
It's going to be really interesting.
Look forward to having you back on Joy on Paper.
Well, thank you so much, Patsy.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Have a good day.
Okay. Woo! It is a good book. See, this is a new author. Wow. And that's what can happen. You never know. It's so funny. I mean, many people have, you know, that you write and you write and you write, and then you get a new book, your first book, and you say, oh my goodness, it's really good. And you get so thrilled with yourself. And again, remember what I said, that there have been some big deals this week. At least I've read about at least 5-6 figure deals, big deals, and it is so much fun when you get that. And another one is Harper's brought Sarah Nelson's book, another 6-figure deal, and it's called Last Train to London. Wow, again a 6-figure deal. So it's the deals are out there. All you have to do is write and check out Publishers Weekly. And please go to Writer's Digest. The deadline for an unpublished book, unpublished work, not just a book, it could be poems, is May 9th. So you still have time to participate in that polish your work and submit it. It's very reasonable. It's like $25 or $35. And as I've told all of you, if you're going to enter a contest, enter one that is relevant and that is important and that is one that has respect from the literary agents and publishers. Don't enter all of these ones that they send you on the internet. All these, those are mostly scams. They send you things. Enter this, enter that, enter this. Don't do it. They are mostly scams, I've discovered, and I'm really sorry when people are spending money on stuff that won't get them anywhere. But Nancy Peacock entered her book in one of the Writer's Digest contests, and that was for a published book. They read it, and they gave her a big contract and republished it. So if it can happen, it's up to you to stay on top of things and to find out about agents. So remember, always do your research. And what else? Oh, I've got coming up, it's going to be really exciting. At the end of the month, I have back on the program Lawrence Block. He is, of course, the mystery writer of American Grandmaster. He was here at BoucherCon, and it was so much fun to meet him. And I hope that if you are interested, you should think about attending BoucherCon in Dallas. Go to BoucherCon 2019 and register. And meanwhile, please go to my website. It's radio-joyonpaper.com. You can see the interviews that I've had. You can check out some of the upcoming guests and a lot more. And particularly next week, I have Bill Larson of Larson & Larson. He will be answering your intellectual property questions. And there is a form right on the front page of my webpage. Just submit your question, and I will have it here ready for Bill when he's here, and he will answer it. Because remember, your intellectual property is, that is your asset. That is what is of value, and you have to protect it. So there have been quite a few changes also in intellectual property beginning this year in 2019. So it's something that you will want to know about. But remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or maybe one day to hear them, these magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a film or a streaming video. And I hope one day Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mysteries will be on Hallmark Channel, because they're great. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, who got everybody on the phone for me today. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Have a great day.